By then, Morrison had also arrived, and the three of us met in the Institute's tea room to formulate a strategy. We agreed that the central goal was to determine whether the evolution of Calabi-Yau spaces previously discussed can actually occur in our universe. But a direct attack on the question was forbidding, because the equations describing this evolution are extremely difficult, especially when the spatial tear occurs. Instead, we chose to rephrase the issue using the mirror description, hoping that the equations involved might be more manageable. As a number of us had already realized, it turns out that in the mirror rephrasing, it appears that string physics is perfectly well-behaved and encounters no catastrophes. There does not seem to be any pinching or tearing. However, the real question this observation raised for us was this: were we pushing mirror symmetry beyond the bounds of its applicability? Although we had solid reason to believe that the powerful mirror relationship holds for the shape progression leading to the tear, the pinching, then growing a new sphere, we realized that no one knew whether that sequence and the mirror rephrasing sequence continued to be mirrors after the tear has occurred. This is a crucial question, because if they are, then the absence of a catastrophe in the mirror perspective would mean an absence in the original, and we would have demonstrated that space can tear in string theory. We realized that this question could be reduced to a calculation. Extract the physical properties of the universe for the first Calabi-Yau shape after the tear and for its supposed mirror, and see if they are identical. It was this calculation to which Aspinwall, Morrison, and I devoted ourselves in the fall of 1992. Late nights at Einstein's final stomping ground. Edward Witten's razor-sharp intellect is clothed in a soft-spoken demeanor that often has a wry, almost ironic edge. He is widely regarded as Einstein's successor in the role of the world's greatest living physicist. Some would even go further and describe him as the greatest physicist of all time. He has an insatiable appetite for cutting-edge physics problems, and he wields tremendous influence in setting the direction of research in string theory. The breadth and depth of Witten's productivity is legendary. His wife, Chiara Nappi, who is also a physicist at the Institute, paints a picture of Witten sitting at their kitchen table, mentally probing the edge of string theory knowledge, and only now and then returning to pick up pen and paper to verify an elusive detail or two. Another story is told by a postdoctoral fellow who, one summer, had an office next to Witten's. He describes the unsettling juxtaposition of laboriously struggling with complex string theory calculations at his desk while hearing the incessant rhythmic patter of Witten's keyboard as paper after groundbreaking paper poured forth directly from mind to computer file. A week or so after I arrived, Witten and I were chatting in the Institute's courtyard, and he asked about my research plans. I told him about the space-tearing flops and the strategy we were planning to pursue. He lit up upon hearing the ideas, but cautioned that he thought the calculations would be horrendously difficult. He also pointed out a potential weak link in the strategy I described, having to do with some work I had done a few years earlier with Vaffa and Warner. The issue he raised turned out to be only tangential to our approach for understanding flops, but it started him thinking about what ultimately turned out to be related and complementary issues. Aspinwall, Morrison, and I decided to split our calculation in two pieces. At first, a natural division might have seemed to involve first extracting the physics associated with the final Calabi-Yau shape from the pinched sequence, and then doing the same for the final Calabi-Yau shape from the mirror rephrasing sequence. If the mirror relationship is not shattered by the tear in the pinched Calabi-Yau, then these two final Calabi-Yau shapes should yield identical physics, just like the two initial Calabi-Yau shapes from which they evolved. This way of phrasing the problem avoids doing any of the very difficult calculations involving the pinched Calabi-Yau shape just when it tears. It turns out, though, that calculating the physics associated with the final Calabi-Yau shape in the pinch sequence is pretty straightforward. The real difficulty in carrying out this program lies in first figuring out the precise shape of the final Calabi-Yau space in the mirror sequence, and then in extracting the associated physics. A procedure for accomplishing the second task, extracting the physical features of the final Calabi-Yau space, once its shape was precisely known, had been worked out a few years earlier by Candelas. His approach, however, was calculationally intensive, and we realized that it would require a clever computer program to carry it out in our explicit example. Aspinwall, who in addition to being a renowned physicist is a crackerjack programmer, took on this task. Morrison and I set out to accomplish the first task, namely to identify the precise shape of the candidate mirror Calabi-Yau space. It was here that we felt Batyrev's work could provide us some important clues. Once again, though, the cultural divide between mathematics and physics, in this case between Morrison and me, started to impede progress. We needed to join the power of the two fields to find the mathematical form of the mirrored Calabi-Yau shapes that should correspond to the same physical universe as the pinched Calabi-Yau shapes, if flop tears are within nature's repertoire. But neither of us was sufficiently conversant in the other's language to see clear to reaching this end. It became obvious to both of us that we needed to bite the bullet. Each of us needed to take a crash course in the other's field of expertise. And so, we decided to spend our days pushing forward as best we could on the calculation while spending evenings being both professor and student in a class of one. I would lecture to Morrison for an hour or two on the relevant physics. He would then lecture to me for an hour or two on the relevant mathematics. School would typically let out at about 11 p.m. We stuck to the program day in and day out. Progress was slow, but we could sense that things were starting to fall into place. Meanwhile, Witten was making significant headway on reformulating the weak link he had earlier identified. His work was establishing a new and more powerful method of translation between the physics of string theory and the mathematics of the Calabi-Yau spaces. Aspinwall, Morrison, and I had almost daily impromptu meetings with Witten at which he would show us new insights following from his approach. As the weeks went by, it gradually became clear that, unexpectedly, his work, from a vantage point completely different from our own, was converging on the issue of flop transitions. Aspinwall, Morrison, and I realized that if we didn't complete our calculations soon, Witten would beat us to the punch. Of six packs and working weekends. Nothing focuses the mind of a physicist like a healthy dose of competition. Aspinwall, Morrison, and I went into high gear. It's important to note that this meant one thing to Morrison and me, and quite another to Aspinwall. Aspinwall is a curious mixture of upper-class British sensibility, largely a reflection of the decade he spent at Oxford as both an undergraduate and a graduate student, infused ever so slightly with a prankster's roguishness. As far as work habits go, he is perhaps the most civilized physicist I know. While many of us work deep into the evening, he never works past 5 p.m. While many of us work weekends, Aspinwall does not. He gets away with this because he is both sharp and efficient. Going into high gear for him merely amounts to notching up his efficiency level to even greater heights. By this time, it was early December. Morrison and I had been lecturing to one another for several months, and it was starting to pay off. We were very close to being able to identify the precise shape of the Calabi-Yau space we were seeking. Moreover, Aspinwall had just about finished his computer code, and he now awaited our result, which would be the required input for his program. It was a Thursday night when Morrison and I finally had confidence that we knew how to identify the sought-after Calabi-Yau shape. That, too, boiled down to a procedure that required its own fairly simple computer code. By Friday afternoon, we had written the program and debugged it, By late Friday night, we had our result. But it was after 5 p.m., and it was Friday. Aspinwall had gone home and would not return until Monday. There was nothing we could do without his computer code. Neither Morrison nor I could imagine waiting out the whole weekend. We were on the verge of answering the long-pondered question of spatial tears in the fabric of the cosmos, and the suspense was too much to bear. We called Aspinwall at home. At first, he refused to come to work the next morning, as we asked. But then, after much groaning, he consented to join us, as long as we bought him a six-pack of beer. We agreed. A moment of truth. We all met at the Institute Saturday morning as planned. It was a bright, sunny morning, and the atmosphere was jokingly relaxed. I, for one, half expected that Aspinwall would not show up. Once he did, I spent 15 minutes extolling the import of this first weekend he had come into the office. He assured me it wouldn't happen again. We all huddled around Morrison's computer in the office he and I shared. Aspinwall told Morrison how to bring his program up on the screen and showed us the precise form for the required input. Morrison appropriately formatted the results we had generated the previous night, and we were set to go. The particular calculation we were performing amounts, roughly speaking, to determining the mass of a certain particle species, a specific vibrational pattern of a string, when moving through a universe whose Calabi-Yau component we had spent all fall identifying. We hoped, in line with the strategy discussed earlier, that this mass would agree identically with a similar calculation done on the Calabi-Yau shape emerging from the space-tearing flop transition. The latter was the relatively easy calculation, and we had completed it weeks before. The answer turned out to be 3, in the particular units we were using. Since we were now doing the purported mirror calculation numerically on a computer, we expected to get something extremely close to, but not exactly, 3, something like 3.000001, or 2.999999, with the tiny difference arising from rounding errors. Morrison sat at the computer with his finger hovering over the Enter button. With the tension mounting, he said, "Here goes," and set the calculation in motion. In a couple of seconds, the computer returned its answer, 8.999999. My heart sank. Could it be that space-tearing flop transitions shatter the mirror relation, likely indicating that they cannot actually occur? Almost immediately, though, we all realized that something funny must be going on. If there was a real mismatch in the physics following from the two shapes, it was extremely unlikely that the computer calculation should yield an answer so close to a whole number. If our ideas were wrong, there was no reason in the world to expect anything but a random collection of digits. We had gotten a wrong answer, but one that suggested, perhaps, that we had just made some simple arithmetic error. Aspinwall and I went to the blackboard, and in a moment we found our mistake. We had dropped a factor of 3 in the simpler calculation we had done weeks before. The true result was 9. The computer answer was therefore just what we wanted. Of course, the after-the-fact agreement was only marginally convincing. When you know the answer you want, it is often all too easy to figure out a way of getting it. We needed to do another example. Having already written all of the necessary computer code, this was not hard to do. We calculated another particle mass on the pinched Calabi-Yau shape, being careful this time to make no errors. We found the answer, 12. Once again, we huddled around the computer and set it on its way. Seconds later, it returned 11.999999. Agreement. We had shown that the supposed mirror is the mirror, and hence, space-tearing flop transitions are part of the physics of string theory. At this, I jumped out of my chair and ran an unrestrained victory lap around the office. Morrison beamed from behind the computer. Aspinwall's reaction, though, was rather different. "That's great, but I knew it would work," he calmly said. "And where's my beer?" Witten's approach. That Monday, we triumphantly went to Witten and told him of our success. He was very pleased with our result, and as it turned out, he too had just found a way of establishing that flop transitions occur in string theory. His argument was quite different from ours, and it significantly illuminates the microscopic understanding of why the spatial tears do not have any catastrophic consequences. His approach highlights the difference between a point-particle theory and string theory when such tears occur. The key distinction is that there are two types of string motion near the tear, but only one kind of point-particle motion. Namely, a string can travel adjacent to the tear, like a point-particle does, but it can also encircle the tear as it moves forward. In essence, Witten's analysis reveals that strings which encircle the tear, something that cannot happen in a point-particle theory, shield the surrounding universe from the catastrophic effects that would otherwise be encountered. It's as if the world sheet of the string, recall from Chapter 6 that this is a two-dimensional surface that a string sweeps out as it moves through space, provides a protective barrier that precisely cancels out the calamitous aspects of the geometrical degeneration of the spatial fabric. You might well ask, what if such a tear should occur, and it just so happens that there are no strings in the vicinity to shield it? Moreover, you might also be concerned that at the instant in time that a tear occurs, a string, an infinitely thin loop, would provide as effective a barrier as shielding yourself from a cluster bomb by hiding behind a hula hoop. The resolution to both of these issues relies on a central feature of quantum mechanics that we discussed in Chapter 4. There we saw that in Feynman's formulation of quantum mechanics, an object, be it a particle or a string, travels from one location to another by sniffing out all possible trajectories. The resulting motion that is observed is a combination of all possibilities, with the relative contributions of each possible trajectory precisely determined by the mathematics of quantum mechanics. Should a tear in the fabric of space occur, then among the possible trajectories of traveling strings are those that encircle the tear. Even if no strings seem to be near the tear when it occurs, quantum mechanics takes account of physical effects from all possible string trajectories, and among these are numerous, infinite in fact, protective paths that encircle the tear. It is these contributions that Witten showed precisely to cancel out the cosmic calamity that the tear would otherwise create. In January 1993, Witten and the three of us released our papers simultaneously to the Electronic Internet Archive through which physics papers are immediately made available worldwide. The two papers described, from our widely different perspectives, the first examples of topology-changing transitions, the technical name for the space-tearing processes we had found. The long-standing question about whether the fabric of space can tear had been settled quantitatively by string theory. Consequences. We have made much of the realization that spatial tears can occur without physical calamity. But what does happen when the spatial fabric rips? What are the observable consequences? We have seen that many properties of the world around us depend upon the detailed structure of the curled-up dimensions. And so, you would think that the fairly drastic transformation from one Calabi-Yau to another would have a significant physical impact. If we could visualize six-dimensional geometry, we would see that, yes, the fabric is tearing, but it does so in a fairly mild way. It's more like the handiwork of a moth on wool than that of a deep knee bend on shrunken trousers. Our work, and that of Witten, show that physical characteristics, such as the number of families of string vibrations and the types of particles within each family, are unaffected by these processes. As the Calabi-Yau space evolves through a tear, what can be affected are the precise values of the masses of the individual particles, the energies of the possible patterns of string vibrations. Our papers showed that these masses will vary continuously in response to the changing geometrical form of the Calabi-Yau component of space, some going up, while others go down. Of primary importance, though, is the fact that there is no catastrophic jump, spike, or any unusual feature of these varying masses as the tear actually occurs. From the point of view of physics, the moment of tearing has no distinguishing characteristics. This point raises two issues. First, we have focused on tears in the spatial fabric that occur in the extra six-dimensional Calabi-Yau component of the universe. Can such tears also occur in the more familiar three extended spatial dimensions? The answer almost certainly is yes. After all, space is space, regardless of whether it is tightly curled up into a Calabi-Yau shape or is unfurled into the grand expanse of the universe we perceive on a clear, starry night. In fact, we have seen earlier that the familiar spatial dimensions might themselves actually be curled up into the form of a giant shape that curves back on itself, way on the other side of the universe, and that therefore even the distinction between which dimensions are curled up and which are unfurled is somewhat artificial. Although our and Witten's analyses did rely on special mathematical features of Calabi-Yau shapes, the result, that the fabric of space can tear, is certainly of wider applicability. Second, could such a topology-changing tear happen today or tomorrow? Could it have happened in the past? Yes. Experimental measurements of elementary particle masses show their values to be quite stable over time. But if we head back to the earliest epochs following the Big Bang, even non-string-based theories invoke important periods during which elementary particle masses do change over time. These periods, from a string-theoretic perspective, could certainly have involved the topology-changing tears discussed in this chapter. Closer to the present, the observed stability of elementary particle masses implies that if the universe is currently undergoing a topology-changing spatial tear, it must be doing it exceedingly slowly, so slowly that its effect on elementary particle masses is smaller than our present experimental sensitivity. Remarkably, so long as this condition is met, the universe could currently be in the midst of a spatial rupture. If it were occurring slowly enough, we would not even know it was happening. This is one of those rare instances in physics in which the lack of a striking observable phenomenon is cause for great excitement. The absence of an observable calamitous consequence from such an exotic geometrical evolution is testament to how far beyond Einstein's expectations string theory has gone. Chapter 12. Beyond Strings. In Search of M Theory. In his long search for a unified theory, Einstein reflected on whether God could have made the universe in a different way, that is, whether the necessity of logical simplicity leaves any freedom at all. With this remark, Einstein articulated the nascent form of a view that is currently shared by many physicists. If there is a final theory of nature, one of the most convincing arguments in support of its particular form would be that the theory couldn't be otherwise. The ultimate theory should take the form that it does because it is the unique explanatory framework capable of describing the universe without running up against any internal inconsistencies or logical absurdities. Such a theory would declare that things are the way they are because they have to be that way. Any and all variations, no matter how small, lead to a theory that, like the phrase, "this sentence is a lie," sows the seeds of its own destruction. Establishing such inevitability in the structure of the universe would take us a long way toward coming to grips with some of the deepest questions of the ages. These questions emphasize the mystery surrounding who or what made the seemingly innumerable choices apparently required to design our universe. Inevitability answers these questions by erasing the options. Inevitability means that, in actuality, there are no choices. Inevitability declares that the universe could not have been different. As we will discuss in Chapter 14, nothing ensures that the universe is so tightly constructed. Nevertheless, the pursuit of such rigidity in the laws of nature lies at the heart of the unification program in modern physics. By the late 1980s, it appeared to physicists that although string theory came close to providing a unique picture of the universe, it did not quite make the grade. There were two reasons for this. First, as briefly noted in Chapter 7, physicists found that there were actually five different versions of string theory. You may recall that they are called the Type 1, Type 2A, Type 2B, Heterotic O32, Heterotic O for short, and Heterotic E8 times E8, Heterotic E for short, theories. They all share many basic features. Their vibrational patterns determine the possible mass and force charges. They require a total of 10 space-time dimensions. Their curled-up dimensions must be in one of the Calabi-Yau shapes, etc. And for this reason, we have not emphasized their differences in previous chapters. Nevertheless, analyses in the 1980s showed that they do differ. They differ in how they incorporate supersymmetry, as well as in significant details of the vibrational patterns they support. Type 1 string theory, for example, has open strings with two loose ends in addition to the closed loops we have focused on. This has been an embarrassment for string theorists because although it's impressive to have a serious proposal for the final unified theory, having five proposals takes significant wind from the sails of each. The second deviation from inevitability is more subtle. To fully appreciate it, you must recognize that all physical theories consist of two parts. The first part is the collection of fundamental ideas of the theory, which are usually expressed by mathematical equations. The second part of a theory comprises the solutions to its equations. Generally speaking, some equations have one and only one solution, while others have more than one solution, possibly many more. For a simple example, the equation 2 times a particular number equals 10 has one solution, 5. But the equation 0 times a particular number equals 0 has infinitely many solutions, since 0 times any number is 0. And so, even if research leads to a unique theory with unique equations, it might be that inevitability is compromised because the equations have many different possible solutions. By the late 1980s, it appeared that this was the case with string theory. When physicists studied the equations of any one of the five string theories, they found that they do have many solutions. For example, many different possible ways to curl up the extra dimensions, with each solution corresponding to a universe with different properties. Most of these universes, although emerging as valid solutions to the equations of string theory, appear to be irrelevant to the world as we know it. These deviations from inevitability might seem to be unfortunate fundamental characteristics of string theory, but research since the mid-1990s has given us dramatic new hope that these features may be merely reflections of the way string theorists have been analyzing the theory. Briefly put, the equations of string theory are so complicated that no one knows their exact form. Physicists have managed to write down only approximate versions of the equations. It is these approximate equations that differ significantly from one string theory to the next. And it is these approximate equations, within the context of any one of the five string theories, that give rise to an abundance of solutions, a cornucopia of unwanted universes. Since 1995, the start of the second superstring revolution, there has been a growing body of evidence that the exact equations, whose precise form is still beyond our reach, may resolve these problems, thereby helping to give string theory the stamp of inevitability. In fact, it has already been established to the satisfaction of most string theorists that, when the exact equations are understood, they will show that all five string theories are actually intimately related. Like the appendages on a starfish, they are all part of one connected entity whose detailed properties are currently under intense investigation. Rather than having five distinct string theories, Physicists are now convinced that there is one theory that sews all five into a unique theoretical framework. And like the clarity that emerges when hitherto hidden relationships are revealed, this union is providing a powerful new vantage point for understanding the universe according to string theory. To explain these insights, we must engage some of the most difficult cutting-edge developments in string theory. We must understand the nature of the approximations used in studying string theory and their inherent limitations. We must gain some familiarity with the clever techniques, collectively called dualities, that physicists have invoked to circumvent some of these approximations. And then we must follow the subtle reasoning that makes use of these techniques to find the remarkable insights alluded to above. But don't worry. The really hard work has already been done by string theorists, and we will content ourselves here with explaining their results. Nevertheless, as there are many seemingly separate pieces that we must develop and assemble, in this chapter it is especially easy to lose the forest for the trees. And so, if at any time in this chapter the discussion gets a little too involved, and you feel compelled to rush on to black holes, chapter 13, or cosmology, chapter 14, take a quick glance back at the following section, which summarizes the key insights of the second superstring revolution. A summary of the second superstring revolution. The five-string theories were thought of as being completely separate, but with the newfound insights emerging from recent research, we see that, like the starfish's five arms, all of the string theories are now viewed as a single, all-encompassing framework. In fact, by the end of this chapter, we will see that even a sixth theory, a sixth arm, will be merged into this union. This overarching framework has provisionally been called M-theory, for reasons that will become clear as we proceed, a landmark achievement in the quest for the ultimate theory. Seemingly disconnected threads of research in string theory have now been woven together into a single tapestry, a unique, all-encompassing theory that may well be the long-sought theory of everything. Although much work remains to be done, there are two essential features of M-theory that physicists have already uncovered. First, M-theory has 11 dimensions, 10 space and 1 time. Somewhat as Kaluza found that one additional spatial dimension allowed for an unexpected merger of general relativity and electromagnetism, string theorists have realized that one additional spatial dimension in string theory, beyond the 9 space and 1 time dimensions discussed in preceding chapters, allows for a deeply satisfying synthesis of all five versions of the theory. Moreover, this extra spatial dimension is not pulled out of thin air. Rather, string theorists have realized that the reasoning of the 1970s and 1980s that led to 1 time and 9 space dimensions was approximate, and that exact calculations, which can now be completed, show that one spatial dimension had hitherto been overlooked. The second feature of M-theory that has been discovered is that it contains vibrating strings, but it also includes other objects. Vibrating two-dimensional membranes, undulating three-dimensional blobs, called three-brains, and a host of other ingredients as well. As with the 11th dimension, this feature of M-theory emerges when calculations are freed from reliance on the approximations used prior to the mid-1990s. Beyond these and a variety of other insights attained over the last few years, much of the true nature of M-theory remains mysterious, one suggested meaning for the M. Physicists worldwide are working with great vigor to acquire a full understanding of M-theory, and this may well constitute the central problem of 21st century physics. An approximation method. The limitations of the methods physicists have been using to analyze string theory are bound up with something called perturbation theory. Perturbation theory is an elaborate name for making an approximation to try to give a rough answer to a question, and then systematically improving this approximation by paying closer attention to fine details initially ignored. It plays an important part in many areas of scientific research, has been an essential element in understanding string theory, and, as we now illustrate, is also something we encounter frequently in our day-to-day lives.